This lecture, Tracing Boards by Harry Mendoza, is the 18th of 20 lectures supplied to members of Quattrocoronati Correspondence Circle on audio cassette in 1989. Worshipful Brother Don Ray, the preceptor of the Linford Lodge of Research, was given permission for the transcription and including on the Linford website in July 2021. Copyright of the audio material is retained by Quattrocoronati Correspondence Circle.
Let's start by asking three questions. What are the tracing boards? What are they for? How did they become part of the lodge furniture? The craft lectures supply an answer to the first two questions. We are told that the tracing boards are one of the immovable jewels of the lodge because they lie open and immovable in the lodge and are for the master to lay lines and draw designs on and for the brethren to moralize on. The answer to the third question is that over the years, and for purely practical reasons, they developed from serving a fundamental purpose to their present form. Now, any one of you could quite rightly say that the answer to the first two questions isn't true, and that the answer to the third question needs more explanation. So, what are the facts? Firstly, they are not immovable. Secondly, the master does not lay lines and draw designs on them. And thirdly, the brethren only moralize on them when the appropriate section of the lecture is being worked, and that is not done by many members. Our study goes back to the various manuscripts that were written before the 17th century and to what are known as the exposures or the unlawful publication of Masonic secrets. Those publications purported to give the obligation and catechisms practiced by Masons. Catechisms were used as a method to enable members of the fraternity to gain knowledge. They were questions and answers similar in fashion to those used in present-day lodges when the candidate has to answer questions leading from one degree to another. Before proceeding further, three points should be made clear. Firstly, the development of the tracing board was not consistent throughout the country in time or place. Secondly, the method of development I am about to outline has been simplified to show the broad pattern. And thirdly, the derivation of the phrase tracing board cannot be stated with absolute certainty. The medieval Master Mason had to delineate his plan and work out the stresses and strains required in order to be able to instruct his men to carry out the work. This was all part of the mystery of the craft. Mystery, probably developing from the French word mestier, later anglicized to métier, meaning art of craft. In some early obligations, we find the new entrant or candidate undertaking, amongst other things, not to reveal any part of what you hear or see at this time, neither by word nor write, nor put it into write at any time, nor draw with the point of a sword or any instrument upon the snow or sand. This finds a reflection in the phrase used today: indite, carve, mark, engrave, or otherwise them delineate. The apprentice at this stage was not yet qualified to lay lines and draw designs. That had to wait until he was qualified and became a master. When we come to the end of the 1700s, operative masonry had largely been replaced in England by speculative Freemasonry. Like some other things connected with operative Masonry, the drawing board, for want of a better term at this stage, was transferred to the meeting place. In fact, it became known as the Lodge. Because of its somewhat secret nature, it was not printed or painted. It was a freshly made drawing done by the tiler just before each meeting began. The material used was chalk and charcoal. At this period, meetings were held in inns or taverns, and the room in which the members met would be put to other uses when their proceedings were finished. Before vacating the room, all traces of the lodge had to be erased. This job was done by the newly made mason, whatever his station in life. He was supplied with a mop and pail and told to get on with the job. This practice, in fact, seems to have been public knowledge, for there was at least one reference in the broadsheets of the day to the great indignity of the mop and pail. This was an era when Freemasonry was being freely ridiculed. Sometimes, instead of drawing the lodge, it was delineated by tapes. These could easily be taken up afterwards and had the advantage of not imposing any indignity on those who felt that the job of charring should not be done by gentlemen masons. Possibly, too, the effect of the ridicule in the broadsheets may also have had an effect. The shape of the lodge seems to have varied. Some disclosures give it as cruciform, that is to say, in the form of a cross. Some say it was triangular, and others oblong. One early exposure, published by a man named Samuel Pritchard in 1730, gives it as an oblong square, far better than that hideous word we use in some lectures today, parallelopipedon. Though this word is in fact meant to portray a three-dimensional view of the lodge. A symbolic reason can be given for each of these shapes. Cruciform can be said to represent the Holy Cross. Triangular can be said to represent the deity, and oblong square can be said to represent King Solomon's temple. That is a reference to the first book of Kings, chapter 6, verse 2, which gave the measurements of the ground plan as 60 by 20 cubits. However, I am not prepared to say whether the shape of the lodge gave rise to the symbolism or the symbolism to the shape. As the years went on, some tilers began to decorate the lodge with various emblems that had come to have a Masonic character. Many of these emblems are still with us today. The square, level and compasses, architectural pillars, and Jacob's ladder. Sometimes these were drawn. Possibly they were made with clay. We have a reference in the present-day craft lectures to chalk, charcoal, and clay, said to represent freedom, fervency, and zeal. These same terms were used in an exposure dated 1730. The lodge was still being drawn by the tiler well into the latter part of the 18th century. The Grand Secretary of the Ancients, Lawrence Dermot, made a particular reference to the practice in July 1778. Writing in Ahiman Rezon, their Book of Constitutions, he said, referring to the Moderns or Premier Grand Lodge, "Nor is it uncommon for a tiler to receive 10 or 12 shillings for drawing 2 signposts with chalk, charcoal, etc., and writing Jamaica on one and Barbados on the other. And all this, I suppose, for no other use than to distinguish where these liquors are to be placed in the lodge." This, of course, is a reference to the J and B words, which were said to have been changed around by the Premier Grand Lodge sometime earlier, following the many issues of Pritchard's Masonry Dissected. But all these drawings and models took much time and meant more work, particularly as all traces had to be removed after each meeting. The logical sequence was to have a printed or painted floorcloth representing the form of the lodge. This could easily be stored and was ready for use again at the next meeting. Following the fashion of the times, these floorcloths were often covered with emblematic features. Some cloths were of linen material and some oilcloth. Later on, we find not just one cloth being used, but one for each degree. Some of the emblems had gone, and the emphasis was shifting from the general to the specific. Each cloth depicted features applicable to the story told, or the moral lessons to be drawn from the appropriate degree. By this time, many lodges were using such cloths, at least in England and Scotland. They were also used in Ireland, but for some reason, tracing boards are not generally used there today. These floor cloths must have cost money to prepare, and frequent use and rolling up would tend to give them a comparatively short life. The next step was to protect the cloth by having it mounted and framed. We have to go back a little bit in time now. Some years earlier, the practice of putting the cloth on the floor had ceased. It was more usual to put it on a table or a board supported by trestles. Meetings were still taking place in taverns. So what might be termed the convivial side was still taking place in the same room as the lodge proceedings. It was not unusual for toasts to be drunk during the period devoted to the questions and answers. Now we have arrived at what became known as the trestle board in the centre of the lodge. The members would sit round the trestle board, and the questions and answers would be rehearsed. The name trestle board was generally used, but there were variations, probably more as a result of local dialect than anything else. Gradually, however, the phrase tracing board came into prominence. However, I should point out that the term tracing board is thought by some to have derived from the French term planche à tracer, a phrase found in a French exposure of 1745, which refers to a drawing of the lodge. In a later English translation, it is made to refer to the floor to be delineated on, and takes the form of a square block or tracing board. Four other changes were taking place that had a bearing on the next development. The questions and answers, or catechisms, were giving way to the narrative. The ceremonies were becoming longer, and the emphasis shifted from the floorcloth to working the degree. There was a more active participation in the ceremonies by some of the officers of the lodge, particularly in those lodges owing allegiance to the Grand Lodge of the Ancients. They employed deacons. The moderns did not. And although meetings were still taking place in taverns, there was a tendency to after proceedings. Labour first, refreshment later. As a result of those four things, it was no longer necessary for the brethren to sit around the trestle board. Their seats could be moved back, and a smaller floor cloth could be used, suitably framed, and placed on the floor again in the centre of the lodge, its traditional place. Now this meant that the officers could now conduct the candidate around the lodge, so that the brethren in the north, south, east and west could see that he was properly prepared. In conducting him round, they would be careful not to step on or over the tracing board now on the floor in the centre of the lodge. The beginnings of squaring the lodge, as we know it today. By this time, there were many more lodges throughout the country. The long-established rivalry between the two grand lodges was coming to an end, giving way to the new United Grand Lodge of England. This led to a tendency to greater uniformity of ritual and lodge proceedings. Whatever the attitude of United Grand Lodge may have been, the attitude of many lodges was perfectly clear, particularly those away from London. They were not going to conform in every respect. It took a long time before there was general conformity on some essential matters, but such conformity was never and has never been achieved in less essential matters. Nor is there any evidence to show that Grand Lodge sought to impose such conformity. A natural corollary of ritual uniformity was the uniformity of lodge furniture, which by now included tracing boards. Such uniformity as does exist was achieved mainly as a result of the Masonic outfitters who were now supplying lodge furniture as well as lodge clothing. Hand painting had given way to printing, and before long the era of mass production had arrived. The Masonic outfitter probably contracted with one of the tracing board painters to print and frame his designs. In time, amalgamations of these outfitters occurred, as, for example, Toy, Kenning, and Spencer, each of which was at one time a separate organization. So one shop now stocked tracing boards bearing slightly different designs. Many of the boards were quite small. I would now like to comment on some of the emblems found on the cloths or boards. The pictures found in two early English exposures show only the form of the lodge. However, the earlier French exposures showed pictures of boards bearing a variety of emblems. For example, in a book printed in 1745, there are two pictures, one showing the plan of the Apprentice Fellows Lodge, the other that of the Master's Lodge. The former depicts 33 different items. One early English designer depicts a key hanging from a rung of the ladder in the first degree board. This was the key which should always hang in a brother's defence and never lie to his prejudice, symbolising the tongue of good report. This is found on many boards painted by Josiah Bowring. He also depicted the virtues of faith, hope and charity as female figures. They were previously indicated by the initial letter. Bowring seems to have been the first to use a Hebrew description on the third degree board. Although the border around many boards differ, there is generally speaking one thing in common, and that is the compass points are usually painted on the first and third degree boards. Only occasionally one finds them on the second degree board. I don't know why this should be so. Some early boards do have them. Possibly it is because of the uncertainty that surrounds the position of the winding stairway and the J and B pillars. The winding stairway on most boards I have seen starts from the north. Others show the stairway starting from the south. According to some biblical scholars, the volume of the sacred law indicates that it should start from the south. Traditionally, the junior warden is placed in the south, though in the early lodges his position was in the west. We are told in the explanation of the board that the junior warden stood at the foot of the winding stairway. Because of this, it has been argued that from both a biblical description and the Masonic legend of the present position of the junior warden, the winding stairway should start from the south. This calls into question the orientation of the temple, a subject on which there seems to be a divergence of views. Let me just say that many biblical scholars have expressed the view that King Solomon's temple was orientated east and west, the altar being in the west and the entrance in the east. One eminent Masonic historian has said, although Masonry has kept the east-west axis in its lodges consistent with that of King Solomon's temple, it has changed the orientation so that the entrance to lodges is in the symbolic west. So much for the winding stairs. Incidentally, I have never seen a candidate in the second degree advance to the east by starting from the south, although I know some advance from the center of the lodge. Now let us turn to the B and J pillars. They are found on some early floor cloths, occasionally with a flat top, more usually adorned with globes. Some floor cloths show the globes separately, as they are shown today on Grand Lodge certificates. By about 1760, the globes, whether shown separately or on top of the pillars, were representing heaven and earth. This probably came about because of the early catechisms. How high is your lodge? It reaches to the heavens. How deep? To the center of the earth. The volume of the sacred law tells us that the B pillar was on the left and the J pillar was on the right, but we are not told whether this was viewing them as one entered or came out of the temple, nor are we told whether the left or right was east or west. As I mentioned earlier, some scholars affirm that the temple was orientated east-west, with the entrance in the east and the altar in the west. If this were so, the pillar on the left would be in the south as one walked in, but in the north as one walked out. However, the entrance to our lodges is in the symbolic west. This puts the junior warden in the south, on the left as one walks out of the lodge. The Emulation Lodge of Improvement imply that this is the way the pillars should be viewed. They teach that when the explanation of the board is given, it is placed on the floor, the head towards the master. The candidate is placed at the foot of the board, facing the symbolic east, whilst the brother giving the explanation stands at the head of the board, facing the symbolic west. The pillar stated to be on the left, that is to say, the B pillar, is that on the left of the brother giving the explanation, but on the right of the candidate. This would support the view that the pillars should be viewed as one walked out of the temple. It would also accord with a Jewish historian, Josephus, who wrote, "The Hebrews expressed the east by before, the west by behind, the north by the left hand, and the south by the right hand, according to the position of the man who has his face to the rising sun." The third degree cloths or board invariably depict a coffin. Some early examples show this partly open, so that one sees the corpse inside. Emblems of mortality are also shown, together with other features found on more modern boards. A Hebrew inscription is often seen, sometimes complete, sometimes with words covered up, not for any esoteric reason, simply because of the design of the painting. The meaning of the words is, "The holy temple at Jerusalem was built by Solomon, king of Israel, Hiram, king of Tyre, and Hiram of the tribe of Naphtali the builder in the year 3000. This date, together with the other inscriptions, is often seen painted back to front, and it has been suggested that the designer was responsible for this in the mistaken belief that as Hebrew was written from right to left, so should this date be written. I find this difficult to believe. The initials CCC, chalk, charcoal and clay, and FFZ, freedom, fervency and zeal, may be seen on some third-degree boards. More often, however, one sees the initials of the passwords leading to the degree, the letters TC, and the words of the degree, the letters MB, in Masonic cipher. Also in cipher are the initials HAB and AL, the latter being Anno Lucis. The best-known design of tracing boards was John Harris, after 1813, who dedicated his boards, without permission, to the Grand Master. He won a competition sponsored by the Emulation Lodge of Improvement, and it is probably because of this that his designs are used today more than any other. It has been said that the Lodge of Reconciliation saw their work as including approval of designs of the Lodge boards. A letter written by a brother Broadfoot, a member of the Lodge of Reconciliation, is quoted in respect of this claim. However, that lodge broke up without giving any such approval. There is not, nor has there ever been, an official design. Lodge boards were not supplied by Grand Lodge for use in the first Freemasons' Hall. Following the rebuilding of the hall in the late 1860s, Grand Lodge, in 1873, borrowed the boards belonging to the Emulation Lodge of Improvement, which had been designed by Harris for the purpose of copying them and, presumably, supplying them as part of the lodge furniture to the temples in use in the new hall. The present building, the Masonic Peace Memorial, was opened in 1930. The architects of the new building were then commissioned to produce a new design on a simplified basis which would be suitable for reproduction, but the actual design was left to the artist. However, the design of the lodge boards used at Great Queen Street does not imply that it is the official design. As mentioned earlier, there is no official design. Are the tracing boards an essential piece of furniture of the lodge? The Book of Constitution doesn't mention them, but they do have some official acknowledgement in that they are supplied by Grand Lodge for use in the temples at Freemasons Hall. However, although they are in general use, they are not essential. It is quite in order to be without them, though there are instances where a local ruler will insist that they must be there. The tracing board, once the focal point, is now not even referred to in the actual ceremony of making, passing, or raising. Because of this, some years ago, many lodges shifted the board from the center of the lodge to the front of the junior warden's pedestal. There are some lodges, however, that still put it in the traditional space where the lodge is at labor. One such lodge is Quaetur Coronati. Incidentally, there are some lodges which still have wall cloths fixed to the wall and covered by a curtain, the curtain being drawn aside to show the tracing board appropriate to the degree. Though not referred to in the ceremony of raising, an explanation of some features of that board is usually given in the third degree. Lectures on the other two are sometimes given, more usually on the second degree tracing board, but these lectures are lengthy and are a mixture of biblical history, legend, and philosophy. The history and development of the tracing boards, however, is rarely touched upon. This is a pity, because there is so much Masonic history that can be gained from their study.